want to welcome Marie to the microphone.
Oh, moringa, Aaron, Atamaria, Whangaroa.
Point it the right way.
Yep.
So we talk with Marie every 4 weeks these days about, well, stuff.
Thanks.
So let's talk. Marie is our local councillor therapist. Well, you're not really practicing so much anymore, are you?
Yeah, I'm just part-time now, Aaron. Part-time. I've got another one coming along.
Another councillor?
Another councillor, yep. That'll take over a lot of my work.
Okay. So you're not taking on new clients, certainly?
No.
You would say.
Well, I have. Actually, that's not true. I do take on some clients.
But
I just don't kind of advertise it.
Yeah, well, this is what we just did.
Sorry.
Accidentally. We just advertised it. Marie does not need any more clients, people. You don't headbutt the microphone.
Okay, here we go.
Guests are not allowed to headbutt the microphone.
All right.
So the reason we took a while to get on the air is we were talking about stuff off the air and trying to get our heads around something about how we use language. And it started off with Marie using the phrase family unit. and I have come to understand that means different things. and it gets even more confusing because I'll say to Marie, oh, that's what people say in a church background like yours. And then you say, well, I'm not totally from a church background.
No.
I grew up very differently, and my partner was the leader of a gang at one point, and all those kinds of things happened in your life. The definition of family unit, that makes me think of a nuclear family, but it's not really what you mean when you use it. And there's lots of words like that.
It was interesting, your reaction. I wasn't expecting it.
I'm also a bit tired today, so I'm...
No, that's okay. It's like, well, that's obviously how people are thinking about the family, or hearing that language, the family unit. We were talking off air about how language triggers people or makes them think a certain way, and we can be misunderstood in the language that we're using, and then, like you did, you started to box me into this place of conservative Christian.
Well, I was trying to explain that the use of the word family unit sometimes is associated with like conservative political organisations and conservative religious
Family First, which is
a religious slash political organisation. I would say,
and that offends people, obviously.
Well, and then what happens is, so people hear that phrase, then they attach all those value systems that Family First espouses, and then they might have a completely different set of values, and then they react to it.
Right.
And not everyone is having that reaction. Some people are probably listening and go, what are you talking about, Aaron? But I know that there are some people out there who do, and and we live in a community that's vocally out the other side of, the opposite side of Family First, for example. So I'm aware that listeners could potentially have a reaction to that, and so what we've been doing since then is been unpicking words off the air.
Coexisting, unit, family, I don't know.
Well, coexisting, everyone gets, because it's not a word that's got been used for political purposes, I guess.
And that's what we were talking about too, and then we got to the idea of how we use language and how that's changing. And I'm not sure if I'm up to... or up with all of that. I'm still living, trying to get my head around how language has changed around simple words of being, happy or gay or whatever it is. I can't even think of the words.
Are you old enough to remember a time when gay was just meant happy?
Yeah.
See, I can't remember that. I know about it from movies.
Yeah.
You're not that much older than me.
No, but... Yeah, or maybe our circles were different and the things that we were hearing were different.
It changed pretty fast, I think.
It did.
Sort of 70s or 70s maybe? I'm not sure because I was a little kid then, so...
Yeah, so look, I think that we can get caught up in language and it become like red herrings, and they become the sidetracks from actually having deeper conversations about what's really upsetting us. So, you can get stuck on the idea that I said family unit, and then we go off into all the conservative stuff and my value systems, and, whereas I'm just talking about a family unit because I'm seeing, how important it is that we come together and we have a foundation of the people that we connect with and do life with, and this is our training ground.
A healthy place for a child to grow.
Yeah,
so that's what you're talking about, but I know that, like, I brought up values because I know that's the bit that catches people. We're not always aware of our values, and some
well,
of our...
Maybe we should ask ourselves, what are our values? If you well, sit yeah. down with your partner, and or if on even if you're on your own, you know, sit down and ask. You might not even know what values are. No. Google it.
This is like when I do my interviews with Stephanie Philp. She's really good at like pulling values out of. We did a values elicitation for the radio station a while ago, and so she's really good at that. And that's what's got me thinking about that. And I know that for some people, saying family unit, then they associate that with the organisation Family First, and they associate that with conservative religious politics, like in the US, and things like that.
Yeah, now I'm
not,
lost.
Not, yeah, but yeah, so yeah, and a lot of people are because they're not having that, but that's they're not consciously associating it with those values. They just it reminds them of that, and then because we don't really know our values, like you say, we don't know what our values are unless we've gone through a real careful process to work them out. We just react emotionally because when something contravenes our values, we do react quite violently sometimes, or at least have very strong feelings.
Yeah, we have strong reactions.
So, yeah, so people hear you say, potentially, some people will hear you say family unit and immediately react to that because of all those unconscious associations. And that's what I was thinking of, potentially. And I don't even know who would be doing that, but I consider it a possibility.
Yeah, I find that sad.
Family is family,
and it would be just nice if we could just keep focused on what it is that's important, and probably the most important thing we'll do is family. How you want to do that and what that looks like to you is quite different for all of us. You know, I said to you before, some people consider their animals to be their family. They have nobody, and they have their animals. That's their family.
I think we have this kind of slightly antiseptic turn, caregivers.
Yeah,
you'll see that on government forms and things.
Oh, just a step away from our humanness, eh? Let's just be a caregiver.
Yeah, yeah. Because what we were talking about before off there too, you mentioned about it's that relationship that the baby and the small child has with the adults around them, that where they learn how to be a person. And you mentioned the Romanian children who were orphans and who. What's the story behind that? Tell us the story about that, for those who don't know.
It's a long time ago now. The Romanian children that were all, I think it was around the wartime. I can't even remember.
Was it the breakdown of the communist bloc?
I'm getting lost in it all. All I know is
the
that 80s there were
and 90s, probably.
So many of these children in this institution, no family. They were just looked after. Well, they weren't really. They were kept in cribs.
Kept alive.
They were kept alive. Yeah, that's it. They were just kept alive. And the effects of those children as they grow up, as we know, many studies done on children who don't have those first connections in with their caregiver or parent or whoever it is that's around them, the psychological effects on that child are massive as they grow. Their ability for empathy isn't there, or to connect or love, to feel loved. You know, so those connection points that make us who we are as human beings in this world to relate to other people just is not there. That's really dangerous territory to be in.
And it applies to. I think that applies to all mammals basically. Like if you bring a dog up without adult dogs around, it doesn't know how to be a proper dog.
And if you bring a human up in a dog's environment, the human will act like a dog.
Yeah, that's literally happened. There are case studies of
monkeys or whatever
people
it might
like
be.
That,
you know, and
humans
so
are very adaptable
we
like that.
And we will relate to what is close to us, how we connect and how we see ourselves and our persona and everything is made up from those first connections.
But that emotional connection is an important building block for becoming an adult.
Oh, it's
like
massive.
We can't ignore it.
Yeah.
And we all know that, but we still live in a society where the people who are struggling the most in the world are the parents. We've got now there are people out there saying, "Oh, I was single and I was struggling." Yes, yes, but when you go across population averages, like everyone when they have babies, it's a real struggle. We all know
it's
that.
It's massive.
Yeah,
and as a solo parent, it's massive.
Yeah, and I mean, I did it. There were two of us in our two adults in our family. That was a hell of a struggle doing it by yourself. I can't imagine. So, if this is the most important time to produce humans, as in
their
emotional development. As a society, we don't really do enough.
No, I'm going to use that word because it's a counselling term, you know, to hold something in high regard.
Yeah.
And I do believe that we need to, I think it would be very healthy for us as a society to be holding our families up in high regard. Like they are the most important things we have in this country is our families. To nourish and pour into family will produce healthy human beings. You know, but reality is families are struggling. You know, we're all struggling. We're in a recession, a double recession.
Well, things have been steadily getting harder for families over the last 40 years.
Successive governments.
I'm sick of hearing anyone argue Labor versus National. There's no point. They both did things to create the world that we're in now. And you know, and families sometimes haven't got proper homes to live in now. They certainly haven't got enough financial support to be the level of comfort you need to parent well, right? Because when you're stressed, you don't parent well. When I was stressed, I didn't parent well, right?
None of us do.
Yeah, and so we should be trying to make our parents' lives as stress-free as we can, as we practically can, if we care about the adults that we're going to produce for the future, you know, 20, 30 years' time, what those people are going to be like. We should be doing that now, shouldn't we?
Absolutely. I mean, we've talked about this before, you know, the best thing we can do is pour into our kids, pour into the family, support it, and nourish it. How do we do that when we're in such dire straits when it comes to finances and the stresses out there? So, look, if we go back to the family unit, so to speak, you know, maybe our view could change around that a little bit. So, yes, we might be living in a family with children, but there is the wider family unit too that is community or...
well, there's extended family, then there's community.
There is extended, so, and there is... Well, if you have extended, or that extended family even wants to be involved with you, often that can be where the disconnection can happen because they don't want to be involved or they aren't, and we have nobody. So connection is really, really important.
Yeah, and that's the cycle repeating as well.
Well, for me as a solo parent with two kids, when I was parenting on my own, there were times, I was young, you know, and there were times I was felt really ripped off, like I had nobody, absolutely nobody. And I knew that as a parent living in Wellington, I couldn't, there was nobody around me. I had to be responsible for my kids. And I had other people partying up in my life, you know, they were going out whenever they felt like it, doing whatever they wanted, buying the clothes that they wanted, you know, and I was with my two little kiddies trying to manage my own trauma in my life. And manage to be a parent, you know, managing to be mum and dad to these two wonderful little beings.
Now, the interesting thing is, like, we're talking about the financial situation around a parents these days. Like, back then, the DPB was better than whatever they call it now. And
it was still amazing.
And it was still, well, you say it was amazing, but you were still struggling massively, right?
Yeah, but when I think about it, I was able to get money. I mean, it wasn't a problem to get money to get a house, you know what I mean, to pay for your bond.
Yeah.
You were allowed a washing machine and a fridge.
Yeah.
They were kind of came with your DBP or DB.
DPB.
DPB. You know, whatever that was. And you were allowed, I think it was $250 every 6 months for a top-up if you needed for clothing or something for your kids. It was kind of a top-up that I remember could apply for.
See, now, to me, that's a decent society that looks after its mothers.
Well, it was hard, but it was still, I managed.
Yeah, but the word decent, the phrase decent society is often one of those other ones that gets used by the political right to talk about, and they talk about a different kind of decency, but for me it's so fundamental to look after people who are looking after children.
Yeah, and I think that I never had a worry, I think there, my worry was more at that time was from society and how they viewed me as a solo parent with two kids and knowing that I was a solo parent and I didn't have a partner and, you know, I felt like an outcast. It was just how it was, you know.
Do women still feel like that now?
I don't think so. Maybe not to the degree that I did. For them now, the struggle is more the other way. It's not that maybe we're so much outcasts, it's that we're not given enough money. You know, so back then we were given enough to survive and actually look after our kids. I don't remember struggling. I mean, I could manage my money well. If I can think back to the place I lived in, they weren't bad places. I could get furniture. You were allowed to buy a sofa and bedding. All that sort of stuff was there for you to be able to connect into if you needed to. My stress was from the society.
Yeah, I think that societal thing is still there in this, because I remember we had a neighbour once who talked about something happening, like a guy was delivering something from a hardware, not a hardware store, like some furniture or something from Hamilton, and he must have picked up that she was a single woman, and although there was no dad on the scene, because when he turned up in his truck, he'd like dressed up and had some
I can imagine that
some aroma or something. So,
well, you know, actually, what we were told,
we still are critical of solo mums. They're still a political football.
We're vulnerable. Solo mums are vulnerable, and that's shocking. It's terrible. I mean, I remember being told to make sure you put a pair of men's boots outside your door, you know, up on your veranda or something, when you had people coming around, because then they would think there was somebody in the house.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we used to do. So those things wouldn't happen, Aaron, because, yes, you were vulnerable as a single woman. And unfortunately...
some of that's just a little bit creepy, but you don't know exactly...
Well, unless you're living it, you don't know the creepiness of it.
You don't know how creepy it's going to be.
So buy the boots. Maybe that'll deal with the creepy side of all of that.
Get some secondhand
boots. You have to think outside the square sometimes as a solo person with children because,
But that attitude has enabled the political thing that's brought down the funding levels for solo parents. And a lot of people, lots of people get angry when they start talking about solo parents and how dare they sponge off the state and they should have planned better and things like that. I'm not interested in that argument because there are babies and small children who need looking after. And if we care about our country, even if you don't care about those people, if you care about your country, you're going to want some functional adults at the end of this process.
Yeah, so, because they are going to be in our society.
Yeah, yeah, so get real, you know, stop scapegoating people. Yeah. And how do we know?
How do we know that what's happening around in our country at the moment isn't the repercussions of what we got wrong back in our family units many, many years ago? That there are people walking around angry, hurt, broken, unloved, and unlovable.
So now here's where the discussion goes. They say, "Well, those parents should have taken responsibility." Like it's more judgment, and they say and the blame goes on the parent. It was the parent's fault. But as we know from talking about how you raise children, it's not just about the parents, it's about the wider extended family, the community, and finally, and I would say the country. And if we're creating an environment where it's harder for parents to raise children, then that's on us as society. We all individually are part of that society. We all have to take that on.
Yep. So if we see a child in our community who has been labelled, right, who's maybe doesn't quite fit the same way as everyone else, acts a little bit differently, you know, they start to get labelled with certain names, and that label goes outside of the family and it becomes something that the school or kids in the school kind of know too. And that label might go out into the community for that child. Oh, that child is blah, 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 whatever, whatever. And they will name these children, right? So that child will get a feeling for how people view them. And they will start to live out of what we say to them.
Yeah.
You get somebody come into that child's life, you only need two, maybe one or two people that will see something good over and outside what everyone else is speaking into that child, you know, and see the qualities or the value. And, man, you will see that child change. You know, we can name our child a bratty child or naughty or just... I don't know, whatever language we might be using to undercut our children a little bit, not let them be who they are. Those labels, those languages that we use over our kids, other people hear them and they start to pick it up too, and they will use that
And how many times have you heard about a kid who changed school and the problems was went away because the yeah. kids at that school didn't know about that label and that reputation
That's right.
they had?
Exactly.
And so suddenly everything was fine.
And everything was good. I mean, if I think back, you know, I mean, I was always labelled the bratty kid or the naughty kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I actually wasn't. And if I if the qualities and I've talked about this before, you know, there was a teacher that luckily I had in my earlier years who saw qualities in me that others didn't, and she gave me some foundation to stand on that made me feel good about myself, even though I felt really bad about myself.
Yeah.
You know, but there was she was a person that is still in my memory. Still yeah. strongly there as a rock solid person, and I'm really thankful for her.
That's the belief. It's about I think it's so much as about belief. The parents or the adults in a kid's life, what they believe about the child, is really important. And they might say, they might try to say things like that catch a kid being good thing. But if they deep down, if they're doing it because they actually think the kid's bad, but you know, if they just believe deep down the kid's bad, then that's going to impact the kid no matter what they do.
And really, like, where does that come from?
Oh, I know, mean, but you hear hear people saying that, you know, oh, you're a bad one.
Yeah, I know. Ooh, snarly, eh?
Yeah.
I had this was terrible for me. Like, I had
well, you had
my dad,
like that.
My dad died of a brain tumour. And there had been a lot of grief around my upbringing anyway. And I had a person speaking to me and my lady, you know, when I was a teenager, or after my dad had passed, saying to me that, you know, I'd caused the stress on my dad's life to bring the brain tumour on.
Oh.
Oh, I know. Gnarly, eh?
How old were you when that happened?
That would have been... Dad died when I was 18, so it was probably when I was about 19.
You're not really ready for that. You're
no.
not ready to handle that.
Well, I didn't handle it at all because I loved my dad massively. I had a great relationship with him. So that really damaged me massively, and it took me a long time to get over that and tell myself
people,
it wasn't.
Why do people say things like this? Is, you know what? Actually, this is
because
something
I was a naughty kid, you see, and it all lined up.
But
as soon
it's
as
also,
that person spoke that into me, it lined up like, yeah, I'm bad. Man.
It's scapegoating as well. I think we need to talk more about scapegoating. Like that's that was. Like this person, whoever said it, was like they didn't like what had happened. It was upsetting.
In my life, it caused stress. Yeah,
and it feels better to have a scapegoat and project everything onto them.
Yeah.
And I don't quite know how that works, but you see that a lot. And solo mums are scapegoats for our society too.
Oh, heck yeah.
Yeah, and you see it in families. Yeah, I was going to say, we see exactly the same thing. And you will see it. You'll have a client come to you and like,
oh, yeah.
that one child in that family is the one who was
you
bad.
Poor thing.
And yeah, and yeah. And
yeah, unfortunately.
From the outside, we can see clearly that it's not the child's fault that things were wrong in the family, but they bear the weight of it.
And so there's the importance of the outer community or those extended families that we connect to. So if something is not going well in the family, then perhaps these people will notice it and try and even up what's missing and speak things in that the kids aren't hearing. And that, you know, that's what I mean. We want to hold our families in high regard. That's, the parents hold the responsibility. But us outside of that family unit in community can also speak into that family uphold it.
Just blaming the parents is scapegoating as well.
So we could support the, you know, what does those parents need? If those parents are in our community, and I must admit, Raglan is an incredible community that offers so much to families.
Yeah.
I don't think other communities have the supports that we do. Like, we can get food here. Like, we can actually get food, you know. Food will arrive on our doorstep if we need that. You know, if we cried out because we were in need here, somebody I think in our community would turn up. I don't think that happens everywhere, though, people wouldn't feel that security.
Certainly in big cities.
There's a lot of coldness, Aaron. It's a cold place, you know. There's not a lot of real connection. It's just passing by, really. And you might know that face, but you don't. There's no real connection there to it. There's no hello or how you going or anything. And it can be a very lonely. You know, how often we hear that saying, you know, you can be in a crowded room and be so lonely. And it's the truth of life, you know. We can be in a crowded world and be so lonely.
Yeah, the big cities, yeah.
You know?
I wanted to go back to there was something you were saying about kids and speaking into their lives, and that your role as a counsellor at the school, which is something you used to do, and just remind us again about what counselling looked like for those children. Because people will have been to counselling as an adult, or they'll have an idea of what counselling's like for an adult, but that's not really how you did it with kids.
No.
And I feel like that ties into what we've been saying.
Yeah. So within the school, of course, with counselling, it's not quite the same as you do out in community, because the school has a, you know, we have a criteria there that they, really it is about keeping kids in school, keeping them safe and healthy and within that environment. So we're not really wanting to counsel into the to the family unit so
much, unless
we really, really have to. So kids come to the counsellor at the school, they've got, they've already been nailed for something, you know, this kid is doing this, they're behaving out, acting out like this.
They got in trouble, didn't they?
Yeah, there'll be some labels that are coming with these children that have already gives you a picture of what this child is doing. But for me, it's not about what the kid is doing. I just want to make connection with that child. I just want to make say, you know, hi and how's things going? And then I might ask them what they enjoy doing in life, you know, what fires them up, what gets them motivated. Is it sports? Is it arts? Is it, you know, theatre? You know, is it writing? What is it? And I just try and make that. And I will not go to what the problem is, but more so what they gravitate towards that makes them feel good.
Yeah.
And I will try and draw that out more and more, like just really focus on it and ask some questions about it and go deeper and deeper and help them to, you know, feel good about something, feel valued in something. And sometimes when we do that with kids, the value of who they are outdoes the issues, and the issues become less when they start to find out who they are.
Yeah.
And like, man, I really enjoy this. Like, I like drumming, or I like getting behind a guitar, or you know, I love drawing, or you know, or it might be, you know, your sports. You just got to sit and chat with the child, and you will come somewhere to a place of what fires them, what makes them, you know, and it could be something even emotional. It doesn't, it could be colours. You know, you don't have to have something like massive sports person, you know, or a great artist, you know, or a great actor. We're not looking for A students here. We're just looking for connection. And every child has a connection point. There's something that will make them feel good. It might be sewing, you know, knitting. We have no idea what our kids are really, unless we want to sit down and have, you know, some time with them and unpack some things, find out who they are.
How did we get to the point where some of our kids feel like there's nothing in their lives that they're good at?
Because we're not giving them anything. We're not. You know, we've got to inspire our kids. I think that was missing for me when I grew up. There was no inspiration. You know, all we had pretty much tagged for us, you were either a nurse or you were going to be a PA or a secretary, you know.
Teacher, I think teacher was another possibility.
Was another one. Yeah. None of those kind of, none of those were for me. Like, So I kind of didn't fit. Like, what am I going to do? I'm just going to end up on the factory, you know, working in factories and things like that, you know. So, I don't know where I was going with that. I guess what I'm saying is that the different ways that we see ourselves and what people call out in us. You know, if somebody had seen in me, because I was creative, that's what that teacher saw in me back in my early days.
Yeah.
Nobody called that out in me after that. Nobody noticed it or saw it. And I didn't see it in myself, so I didn't go down that track. But man, I wished I had. I wished somebody had said to me, "Oh, Marie, you really, I like, you know, this is, you seem to love doing this." You know, I would have probably flown in it, but nobody was speaking into my life to help me see who I was.
So we also have a view that, well, there's no point teaching art because the kids are going to be doing proper jobs.
Oh, there we go.
But
you don't want to be a singer because there's no money in that.
But you're talking about something different. You're talking about something that's emotionally nourishing for a growing human being.
Yeah.
And that's really important. And
you don't have to be an A at this. You don't have to be the best at it. You just got to enjoy it.
But it's also about, it's raising a child is just not about making sure they're good at English and maths.
Yeah, no. Oh, heck no.
Because that's not taking care of the... Okay, it's taking care of a couple of things that they need as adults, but they also need to be emotionally grounded or emotionally secure. Right? I don't know what phrase you want to use. But
I love it. Emotionally secure would be a nice thing, to know that you are loved, to know that no matter how you look or what your, you know, outward appearance might be, that you're a valued human being. Like, you know, you belong. And you're awesome, just as you are. You know, we can develop anything we want to, but just as you are is enough. You have always been enough. You will always be enough. You are enough. That's it in a nutshell, really. And anything beyond that is development, and it's great.
At our most basic, we are enough.
We are enough. We have always been enough. We will always be enough. It's sad to think that we're not enough. Anything beyond that is a bonus.
And
we're
developing ourselves. I know that, especially for a lot of guys, our analytical brains are like, well, but, you know, we didn't do very well at that, and we should be better at that, or they should be better at that, or they're not doing well, and I'm worried about that. But the point is not about being accurate, about an accurate assessment of everything about that kid. The point is about providing them with emotional nourishment.
Yeah, and belief.
And that's the fundamental to everything else.
Yeah.
That's at the basis of everything else. Someone who's, like, emotionally completely messed up is probably not going to be that good, even if they are a talented mathematician.
Yeah, right? And so none of those Romanian children would have gotten any of that, Aaron.
Yeah, right? If you've just tuned in, we were talking earlier about the famous Romanian orphans that were just completely, they were kept alive. That was the best we could say. Mm. They were otherwise uncared for, and they had no emotional contact, and they were unable to develop into functional human beings, basically.
And we don't want to lose this picture because, unfortunately, we have this picture. We've lived through this picture. We do not want to repeat this picture. But this picture gives us a lot of information about what not to do and what we need to be doing. So if we want to learn anything from our history, keep an eye on what happened to those children. Remind yourself of what that was like, because that gives you an indicator of how important it is to be nourishing and nurturing and holding in high regard these precious little lives at the beginning of life and right through up until they are able to have some sense of consciousness and conscience, about life around them and responsibilities and all of that.
Yeah, and it gives a lot of clarity. And how many people do we know who, like, people say, well, we're still worried about their schooling. Well, how many people do we know who did badly at school who made a success of their lives anyway?
Of course. It's a terrible stress that we put on our kids. It's unfortunate, and we don't need to do it because they will – you can nourish a child into development. If you are walking alongside that child, encouraging them, helping them to see their value system, who they are, developing, helping them to develop themselves, that no amount of education is going to be more worthy than that. It's going to be the most worthiness, whatever that word is, that we can do for that person is to, it's like a plant, you know. If you're going to nourish it and provide what it needs, it's going to bloom, you know. It doesn't have to be the most beautiful bloom. It'll still bloom. It'll look beautiful amongst all the other blooms, you know. But you will notice the one that doesn't get fed and becomes unnourished, you'll notice that plant.
And I've started using this phrase that we're emotional machines, which is a completely internally contradictory kind of statement.
No, we need it.
But that makes sense in our culture where we value mechanics and analysis and things like that. We need to understand that emotions are fundamental to producing human beings, not just being good at maths and English and
I can't believe that
writing.
We would ever think emotions aren't the most valuable thing. I just can't believe we would think like that, because right, we'll just end up being mechanical and cold and disconnected.
A lot of people listening will say, but no, we do know emotions are important, but we're still putting our kids in situations where their emotional well-being is compromised because they're not meeting some other standard.
I think
we've prioritised some other standard ahead of them, like their ability to do maths to a certain level or write and spell and things like that.
Maybe that's coming more from the parent than it is the child, I would say. That more the expectation or what is needed
it's
out
just
there.
In the, it's just in the air, you know. Like it's the implication of going to school and getting graded, and that stuff's important. And you hear the message, or you get it's messaging all the time. Like you're acceptable, or you're not acceptable,
oh, yeah.
or you're excelling.
It's
or
always going to be there.
Or you're almost good
but
enough.
But you know how we can contradict that is in our family units, Aaron. You know, they might be getting fed that from the schools or whatever systems they're in.
Yeah.
But our family unit can alleviate that by going, hey, yeah, that's, but it's not everything.
Yeah.
You know, and bringing the fun factor in, bringing the human factor in, being individuals, you know, realising our kids as individual beings and helping them to grow from there. And a lot of that's got to come down to us as parents. How much are we willing to grow and change and develop ourselves so that we can do this amazing job, which is an amazing job. And most of the times we're doing it, we're just fumbling through it, Aaron.
And that's why
it's
we need
the
support.
It's not as though there's a rule book here that we were given, and even if we were given one, it's probably one we would dispute anyway. Things and we go, oh, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, you and rule books, Marie. I know.
So, you know what I mean? Like, you know, just oh my gosh, the best things we'll do is our kids. They're wonderful.
So it's probably time to wrap up. We started off talking about the language confusion. Marie and I interviewed each other for about 15 minutes before we went on the air, trying to work out what we both meant by certain words. But ultimately, there was use of the word family or family unit, and ultimately, the discussion was about what was important behind that word anyway, which is about providing a healthy environment, nurturing environment for kids, also
connection.
For the adults too, though.
And that goes outside of the family. That, you know, there is the wider family and there is the community in family.
Yeah.
All have their part to play and are all part of what makes up a healthy human being.
Yeah. All right, Marie, thank you for coming in.
You're welcome.
And Marie will be on the air midday, Friday. Is
Friday,
that's when your
yes.
show starts? I should know because I'm always here. and we're going to squeeze in a track before we go. Where was it? Hatchie, Adored. I thought that was a good one for now. See you tomorrow.